Blog Talk Radio.
God bless this mess, this test we pass.
Good morning, Hotep family, Hotep. You know, I just want to get right into this morning. It's not that I feel like I'm anywhere. The orator that Dr. King was. But, you know, giving light to all this madness that has been going on the planet, I'm sure at some point you know, not only are you wondering what the hell is really going on, it's almost at a point where you wonder or you say to yourself, all right, God, show your face to the people. And I think that the biggest problem, as I see it, of course, in my humble opinion, is that we fail to realize that we are now in the day of judgment. All the Christians out there, the day that you talk about, the day that you seem to feel that we need to die to be a part of, unfortunately, it's here. And you have to choose what side you on. Who is on the Lord's side? Are you on the side of good, or are you on the side of evil? So if you're on the side of good, then you have to stand up and be counted, because what's that? Faith without works is dead. I think that's what the Bible says, and I think the Quran says best when it says mere belief accounts for nothing unless it is carried into practice. I think we need to really meditate on that, because we are at the time in our life where we have to deal with what's going on, and how are we individually going to take action. Some of us are musicians. Some of us on the planet are poets. Some of us, everybody has a job to do. And if you are a follower of a Christ, or the Christ, or anything Christ-like, or whatever you may call it, then surely whatever you are involved with does not condone injustice. And I guess the reason why I'm going here today is because, you know, I was at the University of Pennsylvania in the African Studies Center, and I just ran across a letter that really, 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 you know, it really pierced my heart, because it was written in April of 63, and in April of 2012, is so relevant. And before I run out of time and run my mouth, I just want to share it with you. And then again, I'm not an orator, as the doctor, as the late great Dr. King was, but maybe the words that sound a little bit even more real if it comes from somebody that's real, okay, that you know, and you don't have to put this mysticism around the reading of this one of the most greatest letters that I think was written to the structure of power. So I'm going to attempt to read this, and I really want you to really meditate on it and meditate on where we at today, okay? My dear fellow clergymen, again, this was written to the people who lead us religiously. This is who the letter was pinned to, so we're going to start there. My dear fellow clergymen, while confined here at the Birmingham City Jail, I came across your recent statement calling my present activities unwise and untimely. Seldom do I pause to answer criticism of my work and ideas. If I sought to answer all the criticisms that come across my desk, my secretaries would have little time for anything other than such correspondence in the course of a day, and I would have no time for constructive work. Keep listening to the word work. Since I feel that you are men of good, genuine goodwill, and that your criticisms are sincerely set forth, I will try to answer your statement in hope that I will be patient and reasonable in what I hope will be patient and reasonable terms. I think I should indicate why I'm here in Birmingham, since you have been influenced by the view which argues against insiders coming in. I have the honor of serving as president of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, an organization that operating in every southern state with headquarters in Atlanta, Georgia. We have some 85 affiliated organizations across the South, and one of them is the Alabama Christian Movement for Human Rights. Frequently, we share staff, educational, and financial resources with our affiliates. Several months ago, the affiliate here in Birmingham asked us to be on call to engage in a nonviolent direct action program if such were deemed necessary. We readily consented, and when the hour came, we lived up to our promise. So I, along with several members of my staff, am here because I was invited here. I am here because I have organizational ties here. But more basically, I am here in Birmingham because injustice is here. And just as the prophets of the 8th century B.C. left their villages and carried their thus saith the Lord far beyond the boundaries of their hometown, and just as the Apostle Paul left his village of Tarsus and carried the gospel of Jesus Christ to the far corners, have mercy now. Okay, let me calm down. And to the far corners of the Greco-Roman world, so am I compelled to carry the gospel of freedom beyond my own hometown. Like Paul, I must constantly respond to the Macedonian call for aid. Moreover, I am cognizant of the interlatedness of all communities and states. I cannot sit idly by in Atlanta and not be concerned about what happens in Birmingham. Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. We are caught in an inescapable network of mutuality tied in a single garment of destiny. Whatever affects one directly affects all indirectly. Never again can we afford to live with the narrow provincial outside agitator idea. Anyone who lives inside the United States can never be considered an outsider anywhere within this bound. You deplore the demonstrations taking place in Birmingham, but your statement, I'm sorry to say, fails to express a similar concern for the conditions that brought about the demonstration. I am sure that none of you would want to rest content with the superficial kind of social analysis that deals merely with effects and does not grapple with the underlying causes. It is unfortunate that demonstrations are taking place in Birmingham. But it is even more unfortunate that the city's white power structure left the Negro community no other alternative. In any nonviolent campaign, there are four basic steps. Collection of the facts to determine whether injustice exists, negotiation, self-purification, and direct action. We have gone through all these steps in Birmingham. There can be no gainsaying the fact that racial injustice engulfs this community. Birmingham is probably the most thoroughly segregated city in the United States. Its ugly record of brutality is widely known. Negroes have expressed grossly unjust treatment in the courts. There have been more unsolved bombings of Negro homes and churches in Birmingham than any other city in the nation. These are hard, brutal facts of the case. On the basis of these conditions, Negro leaders sought to negotiate with the city fathers, but the latter consistently refused to engage in good faith negotiation. Then, last September, came the opportunity to talk with leaders of Birmingham Economic Community. In the course of negotiations, certain promises were made by the merchants. For example, to remove all the store's humiliating racial signs. On the basis of these promises, the Reverend Fred Shuttlesworth and the leaders of the Alabama Christian Movement of Human Rights agreed to a moratorium on all demonstrations. As the weeks and months went by, we realized that we were victims of a broken promise. A few signs, briefly removed, returned. The others remained. As in so many past experiences, our hopes had been blasted, and the shadow of deep disappointment was settled upon us. We had no alternative except to prepare for direct action, whereby we would present our very bodies as a means of laying our case before the conscience of the local and the national community. Mindful of the difficulties involved, we decided to undertake a process of self-purification. We began a series of workshops on nonviolence. We repeatedly asked ourselves, are you able to accept blows without retaliating? Are you able to endure the ordeal of jail? We decided to schedule our direct action program for the Easter season, realizing that except for Christmas, this is the main shopping period of the year. Knowing that a strong economic withdrawal program would be the byproduct of direct action, we felt that this would be the best time to bring pressure to bear on the merchants for the needed change. Then it occurred to us that Birmingham's mayoral election was coming up in March, and we speedily decided to postpone action to after Election Day when we discovered that the Commissioner of Public Safety, Eugene Bull Connor, had piled up enough votes to be in the runoff. We decided again to postpone action until the day after the runoff so that the demonstrations could not be used to cloud the issue. Like many others, we waited to see if Mr. Connor defeated, and this would end. We endured postponement after, and to this end, we endured postponement after postponement. Having aided in this community need, we felt that our direct action program could be delayed no longer. You may well ask, why direct action? Why sit-ins, marches, and so forth? Isn't negotiation a better path? You are quite right in calling for the negotiation. Indeed, this is the very purpose of direct action. Nonviolent direct action seeks to create such a crisis and foster such a tension that a community which has constantly refused to negotiate is forced to confront the issue. It seeks to dramatize the issue so that it can no longer be ignored. My citing the creation of tension as part of the work of nonviolent register may sound rather shocking, but I must confess that I am not afraid of the word tension. I have earnestly opposed violent tension, but there is a type of constructive violent, nonviolent tension which is necessary for growth. Such as Socrates felt that it was necessary to create attention in the mind so that individuals could rise from the bondage of myths and have truth to the unfettered realm of creative analysis and objective appraisal, so must we see the need for nonviolent gadflies to create the kind of tension in society that will help men rise from the dark depths of prejudice and racism to the majestic heights of understanding and brotherhood. The purpose of our direct action program is to create a situation so crisis-packed that it will inevitably open the door to negotiation. I therefore concur with you in your call for negotiation. Too long has our beloved Southland been bogged down in a tragic effort to live in a monologue rather than a dialogue. One of the basic points in your statement is that the action that I and my associates have taken in Birmingham is untimely. Some have asked, why didn't you give the city administration time to act? The only answer I can give to this query is that the new Birmingham administration must be prodded about as much as the outgoing one before it will act. We are sadly mistaken if we feel that the election of Albert Boutwell as mayor will bring the millennium to Birmingham. While Mr. Boutwell is a much more gentle person than Mr. Connor, they are both segregationists, dedicated to the maintenance of the status quo. I have hope that Mr. Boutwell will be reasonable enough to see the futility of massive resistance to desegregation, but he will not see this without pressure from the devotees of civil rights. My friends, I must say to you that we have not made a single gain in civil rights without determined legal and nonviolent pressure. Lamentably, it is a historical fact that privileged groups seldom give up their privileges voluntarily. Individuals may see moral light and voluntarily give up their unjust posture, but as Reinhold Niebuhr has reminded us, groups tend to be more immoral than individuals. We know through painful experience that freedom is never voluntarily given by the oppressor. It must be demanded by the oppressed. Frankly, I have yet to engage in a direct action campaign that was well-timed in the view of those who have not suffered unduly from the disease of segregation. For years now, I have heard the word "fight." It rings in the ear of every Negro with piercing familiarity. This weight has almost always meant never. We must come to see with one of our distinguished jurists that justice too long delayed is justice denied. Okay? We have waited for more than 340 years for our constitutional and God-given rights. The nations of Asia and Africa are moving with jet-like speed towards gaining political independence, but we still creep at horse and buggy pace towards gaining a cup of coffee at a lunch counter. Perhaps it is easy for those who have never felt the stinging darts of segregation to say, wait. But when you have seen vicious mobs lynch your mothers and fathers at will and drown your sisters and brothers at a whim, when you have seen the hate-filled policemen curse, kick, and even kill your black brothers and sisters, when you have seen the vast majority of your 20 million Negro brothers smothered in an airtight cage of poverty in the midst of affluent society, when you suddenly find your tongue twisted and your speech stammering, when you seek to explain to your six-year-old daughter why she can't go to the public amusement park that has just been advertised on television and see the tears welling up in her eyes when she is told that the fun town is closed to colored children. See the anomalous clouds of inferiority beginning to form in her little mental sky, and see her beginning to distort her personality by developing unconsciousness, bitterness towards white people. When you have concocted an answer for a five-year-old son who is asking, Daddy, why do white people treat colored people so mean? When you take a cross-country drive and find it necessary to sleep night after night in the uncomfortable corners of your automobile because no motel will accept you when you are humiliated day in and day out by nagging signs reading white and colored, when your first name becomes nigga and your middle name becomes boy, however old you are, your last name becomes John, and your wife and mother are never given the respected title of Mrs., and when you are harried by day and haunted by night, the fact that you are a Negro, living constantly at a tiptoe stance, never quite knowing what to expect next, and are plagued with the inner fears and outer resentment, when you are forever fighting a degenerating sense of nobodiness, then you will understand why we find it difficult to wait. There comes a time when the cup of endurance runs over, and men are no longer willing to be plunged into the abyss of despair. I hope, sir, that you can understand our legitimate and unavoidable impatience. You express a great deal of anxiety over our willingness to break laws. This is certainly a legitimate concern, since we so diligently urge people to obey the Supreme Court's decision of 1954 outlawing segregation in the public schools. At first glance, it may seem rather paradoxical for us consciously to break law. Well, one may well ask, how can you advocate breaking some laws and obeying others? Well, the answer lies in the fact that there are two types of laws, just and unjust. And I will be the first to advocate obeying just laws. One has not only a legal but moral responsibility to obey just laws. Conversely, one has a moral responsibility to disobey unjust laws. I would agree with St. Augustine that an unjust law is no law at all. Now, what is the difference between the two? How does one determine whether a law is just or unjust? A just law is a man-made code that squares with one moral law or law of God. An unjust law is a code that is out of harmony with the moral law. To put it in terms of St. Augustine, Thomas Aquinas, an unjust law is a human law that is not rooted in the internal law and natural law. Any law that uplifts human personality is just. Any law that degrades human personality is unjust. All segregation statutes are unjust because segregation distorts the soul and damages the personality. It gives the segregationer a false sense of superiority and the segregated a false sense of inferiority. Segregation, to use the terminology of the Jewish philosopher Martin Buber, states, substitutes it an I-it relationship for an I-thou relationship and ends up relegating persons to the status of things. Hence, segregation is not only politically, economically, and socially unsound, it is morally wrong, and it is sinful. Paul Tillich has said that sin is separation. Is not segregation an existential expression of a man's tragic separation, his unlawful estrangement, and his terrible sinfulness? Thus, it is that I urge men to obey the 1954 decision of the Supreme Court, for it is morally right, and I can urge them to disobey segregation ordinances, for they are morally wrong. Let us consider a more concrete example of just and unjust law. An unjust law is a code that a numerical or power majority group compels a minority group to obey, but does not make binding on itself. Okay? This is difference made legal. By the same token, a just law is a code that a majority compels a minority to follow and that it is willing to follow itself. This is the sameness made legal. Let me give another explanation. A law is unjust if it is inflicted on a minority that, as a result of being denied the right to vote, had no part in enacting or devising the law. Who can say that the legislation of Alabama, which set up the state segregation laws, was democratically elected? Throughout Alabama, all sorts of devious methods are used to prevent Negroes from becoming registered voters. There are some counties in which, even though Negroes constitute a majority of the population, not a single Negro is registered. How can any law enacted under such circumstances be considered democratically structured? Sometimes a law is just on its face and unjust in its application. For instance, I have been arrested on a charge for parading without a permit. Now, there is nothing wrong in having an ordinance which requires a parade without a permit, but such an ordinance becomes unjust when it is used to maintain segregation and deny citizens the First Amendment privilege of a peaceful assembly and protest. I hope you are able to see the distinction I am trying to point out. In no sense do I advocate evading or defying the law, as would the rabid segregationist. That would lead to anarchy. One who breaks an unjust law must do so openly, lovingly, and with willingness to accept the penalty. I submit that an individual who breaks a law that conscience tells him is unjust and who willingly accepts the penalty of imprisonment in order to arouse the consciousness of a community over its injustice, in its reality, expresses the highest respect for the law. Of course, there is nothing new about this kind of civil disobedience. It was evident subliminally in the refusal of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and to obey the laws of Nebuchadnezzar on the ground that a higher moral law was at stake. It was practiced superbly by the Christians. They were willing to face hungry lions and the excruciating pain of chopping blocks rather than to submit to a certain unjust law of the Roman Empire. Right? To a degree, academic freedom is a reality today because Socrates practiced civil disobedience. In our own nation, the Boston Tea Party represented a massive act of civil disobedience. We shall never forget that everything Adolf Hitler did in Germany was legal, and everything the Hungarian freedom fighters did in Hungary was illegal. It was illegal to aid and comfort a Jew in Hitler's Germany. Even so, I am sure that had I lived in Germany at that time, I would have aided and comforted my Jewish brothers. If today I live in a communist country where certain principles dear to the Christian faith are suppressed, I would openly advocate disobeying that country's anti-religious law. I must make two honest confessions to you, my Christian and Jewish brothers. First, I must confess that over the past few years, I have been gravely disappointed with the white moderate. I have almost reached a regrettable conclusion that the Negro great stumbling block in his strive for freedom is not the white citizens counselor or the Ku Klux Klaner, but the white moderate who is more devoted than to justice, is more devoted to order than to justice, who prefers a negative peace, which is the method of direct action. Check that out. Let me do that one more time. Wow, that is deep. I have almost reached a regrettable conclusion that the Negro's greatest stumbling block in his stride toward freedom is not the white citizens council or the Ku Klux Klaner, but the white moderate who is more devoted to order than to justice, who prefers a negative peace, which is the absence of tension, to a positive peace, which is the presence of justice, who constantly says, I agree with you in the goal that you seek, but I cannot agree with your methods of direct action, who paternalistically believes he can set the timetable for another man's freedom, who lives by a mythical concept of time, and who constantly advises the Negro to wait for a more convenient season. Shallow understanding from people of goodwill is more frustrating than absolute misunderstanding from people of no will, of ill will. Lukewarm acceptance is much more bewildering than outright rejection. I had hoped that the white moderate would understand that law and order exist for the purpose of establishing justice, and that when they fail in this purpose, they become the dangerous structured dams that block the flow of social progress. I had hoped that the white moderate would understand that the present tension in the South is a necessary phase of transition from the obnoxious negative peace in which the Negro passively accepted in his unjust plight to a substantive and positive peace in which all men will respect the dignity and worth of human personality. Actually, we who engage in nonviolent direct action are not the creators of tension. We merely bring to the surface the hidden tension that is already alive. We bring it out in the open, where it can be seen and dealt with, like a boil that can never be cured so as long as it is covered up, but must be opened with all its ugliness to the natural medicines of air and light, and injustice must be exposed with all the tension its exposure creates to the light of human consciousness and the air of national opinion before it can be cured. In your statement, you assert that our actions, even though peaceful, must be condemned because they precipitate violence. But is this a logical assertion? Isn't this like condemning a robbed man because his possessions of money precipitated the evil act of robbery? Isn't this like condemning Socrates because his unswerving commitment to truth and his philosophical inquiries precipitated the act by the misguided populace in which they made him drink hemlock? Isn't this like condemning Jesus because his unique God consciousness and never ceasing devotion to God's will precipitated the evil act of crucifixion? We must come to see that as federal courts have consistently affirmed, it is wrong to urge an individual to cease his efforts to gain his basic constitutional rights because the quest may precipitate violence. Society must protect the robbed and punish the robber. I had also hoped that the white moderate would reject the myth concerning time in relation to the struggle for freedom. I have just received a letter from a white brother in Texas. He writes, "All Christians know that the colored people will receive equal rights eventually, but it is possible that you are in too great of a religious hurry. It has taken Christians almost 2,000 years to accomplish what it has. The teachings of Christ take time to come to earth. Such an attitude stems from a tragic misconception of time, from the strangely irrational notion that there is something in the very flow of time that will inevitably cure all ills. Actually, time itself is neutral. It can be used either destructively or constructively. The more and more I feel the people of ill will have used time much more effectively than the people of goodwill. Will we have to repeat this generation not merely repent? Will we not have to repent in this generation not merely for the hateful words and actions of the bad people, but for the appalling silence of the good people? Human progress never rolls in on wheels of inevitability. It comes through the tireless efforts of men willing to be co-workers with God. And without this hard work, time itself becomes an ally of the forces of social stagnation. We must use time creatively in the knowledge that the time is always ripe to do the right thing. And now is the time to make the real promise of democracy and transform our pending national elegy into a creative song of brotherhood. Now is the time to lift our national policy from the quicksand of racial injustice to the solid rock of human dignity. You speak of our activity in Birmingham as extreme. At first, I was rather disappointed that fellow clergymen would see my nonviolent efforts as those of an extremist. I began thinking about the fact that I stand in the middle of two opposing forces in the Negro community. One is a force of complacency made up in part of Negroes as a result of long years of oppression, who are so drained of self-respect and a sense of somebodyness that they have adjusted to segregation, and in part of a few middle-class Negroes who, because of their degree in academic and economic security and because in some ways they profit by segregation, have become insensitive to the problems of the masses. The other force is one of bitterness and hatred, and it comes perilously close to advocating violence. It is expressed in various black nationalist groups that are springing up across the nation. And unfortunately, I'm not able to read this last line. It's unfortunate that he had to say this because I do know. Well, maybe I should read it. He said, best known being Elijah Muhammad's Muslim movement. But I do know that he has had since changed his view on that. So that was very hard for me to say that. Nourished by the Negro's frustration over continued existence of racial discrimination, this movement is made up of people who have lost faith in America, who have absolutely repudiated Christianity, who have concluded that the white man is an incorrigible devil. I have tried to stand between these two forces, saying that we need to emulate neither the do-nothingism or the complacent nor the hatred and despair of the black nationalists. For there is more excellent way of love and nonviolent protest. I am grateful to God that through the influence of the Negro church, the way of the nonviolent became an integral part of our struggle. If this philosophy had not emerged by now, many streets in Southwood, and I am convinced, be flowing with blood. I am further convinced that if our white brothers dismissed as rabble-rouser and outside agitators those of us who employ nonviolent and direct action, and if they refuse to support our nonviolent efforts, millions of Negroes will, out of frustration and despair, seek solace and security in black nationalist ideologies, a development that would inevitably lead to a frightening racial nightmare. You know, I'm just going to have to come back and read part two of this letter, y'all, because my time is up. Thanks for listening. Stay tuned for part two tomorrow. Be blessed. Yeah.